From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Texans are paying so much more for home insurance, it's becoming a barrier to owning a home.
If your insurance bill was bad this year, brace for it being even worse next year.
And the documented problems inside the Texas Juvenile Justice Department persist.
I think these numbers speak to, hey, something's going on, and you know that there needs to be more scrutiny of this system and the treatment kids are getting.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Home insurance costs are soaring in Texas, and new research suggests home insurance premiums are playing an increasing role in housing affordability across the state. When homeowners' insurance is factored into the cost of home ownership, nearly two-thirds of Texas households can no longer afford the medium-priced home, according to a new report from the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University and Texas 2036, a statewide public policy organization. Steve Sherman is an author of the study.
Home prices, they took a really big jump in the immediate aftermath of COVID, but the past 2 years have kind of stabilized. Homes really haven't appreciated much in kind of the most recent years. But the reality is that the cost of everything else that comes with home ownership is increasing. Some of those largest increases we're finding are in home insurance. We found that in just 1 year, home insurance increased 30% in Harris County. And that is the most recent in the ACS data. And that's coming off of prior years when it's increased quite a bit as well. So unlike home prices, which took a big jump then have kind of stabilized, insurance prices continue to go up.
And is that true for statewide or major metropolitan areas?
Yeah. So statewide, insurance has increased far faster than inflation. It went statewide from being about 3% of household income in 2009 to about 4.6% in 2024. So about a 50% increase in the amount of the household budget that it takes up in about 15 years. 64% of Texas households could not afford the median valued home in their county if you account for insurance costs in addition to home costs. And a 10% increase in homeowners insurance prices would price out an additional about 50,000 households out of the market. Keep in mind, 10% is already much less than what we've seen here, at least in Harris County. But yes, insurance is making homes less affordable to buy. One of the more interesting things that I found, at least statewide, when you looked at, and this is surprising to me, you know, here I am in Houston, I'm thinking, oh, we have hurricanes and all these awful storms and our no water seems to drain in our city. Despite that, what we actually found is that regions of Texas where you're finding these biggest increases in insurance premiums relative to home value, there's a lot of it happening in West Texas, Northwest Texas, kind of between that big area between Lubbock and DFW. It's where you're finding these big increases, the biggest increases in home in insurance price relative to home value. So what's going on there is that, one, the homes, it's a very rural area. Homes are not as expensive as they are in the big cities. That's one part of it. But also insurance prices have gone up a lot. That's an area, that's Tornado Alley, Hailstorm Alley, Ice Storm Alley. So you're going to find that that's really going to have a big effect on home insurance prices. They're not going to necessarily flood as much, but those other wind and rain damage that is covered by home insurance is really going to affect these rural areas in north central Texas quite a bit.
So the increased risk to homes from these natural disasters, that's driving up the cost of home insurance. And are these risks going up?
One of the interesting things is that oftentimes, it's not just weather or extreme events that triggers big spikes, but we also found they're often correlated with policy changes. For instance, a major court case started to make more insurers liable for paying out mold damage. So that led to a really big increase. And additionally, about in 2001, 20, and 2002. But when we had big storms in Texas with really large payouts, such as Harvey in 2017, there was a smaller increase statewide in insurance premiums, but they really pale in comparison to what's happened recently, where you're finding that in the median county in Texas, insurance rates went up 12%, 13% in prior years, and that's much more than happened even after we had these bad weather disasters like the freeze in 2021, the bad storms in 2017, in the kind of earlier part of the prior decade as well.
So homeowners are feeling this pinch. They're noticing their policies are changing or premiums are going up.
Yeah, and I think I just kind of want to point out that it's happening now, even when we really haven't had over the past 2 years, we haven't had to 2021 freeze. We haven't had a really major hurricane statewide that's really affected a lot of damage. But you're finding these are really the biggest increases we've seen since that ch policy change about 25 years ago, result of mold. They're happening now. So yes, it is going to affect homeowners, and it's increasingly, I think, something that we found that it's going to affect lower income homeowners. We did this calculations and showed that when there are these bigger increases in insurance rates, you're finding that it's not really affecting take up rates or people choosing to drop their insurance if they're already above median income. But if they're below median income, they will, or they're more likely to.
If you have a mortgage, you can't drop your insurance.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't, a lot of homeowners don't have mortgages. There are places that, yeah, it's kind of an interesting statistic, but yeah, you don't have to, after the mortgage goes away, especially retirees on a fixed income, they can drop it.
So that creates a situation that if there is a major disaster and people's homes are wiped out at scale, then and so many don't are no longer insured, they're not required to have it, and they can't afford it, then we're kind of setting up for a big upheaval in housing.
Yeah, especially, I mean, I know that that happened here a lot with older homeowners after Harvey. Like, granted, that was flood insurance, but people on fixed incomes, if they start to drop insurance or lose insurance, it's a big problem.
And I'm hearing a lot about some people can't even get insurance anymore.
I mean, we didn't go into depth about changes in the market, but yes, that is something that if it starts to become so unaffordable, then really, what's your choice? I'm not a homeowner, but my friends who are homeowners, they tell me these stories about when they get their yearly insurance bills are just going up, up, and up, and they're making perhaps serious questions about, like, do we just sell out, take the money, sit on it until the market becomes more sane?
How aware are people of their insurance obligations when they buy a home? And it becomes like we could buy the house, but we can't afford to insurance, so therefore we can't get the house.
That's not something we pursued in this research, but it is a question that you seriously have to act. And I would say, if there's any potential home buyers listening to this, budget in for, it used to be you should have, they was to would tell people to have an additional few $1,000, $10,000 in the bank account after you buy a home, just in case the roof goes, the hot water heater grows. But you also have to think about, what if your insurance spikes 20, 30, 40, 50, 60% over the next 5 years? Which is something that people have seen.
As more people drop out of the insurance market, it reduces the risk pool, and doesn't that make insurance more expensive?
One of the things that, we're finding that if people are, homes are going to be homes, right? Somebody's going to buy them, and they might be rented out, and they'll have to be insured. But if they are purchased, especially if there's renters in them, you'd assume that they're going to be insured. But I do think that there are these larger questions about, like, who's going to foot the bill. I know that there have been some serious changes in home insurance regulation in Florida and other states to encourage insured, but insured, as insured, kind of reflecting how certain insurers have dropped out of certain markets. And, I do wonder what we have coming down the pipeline here. In Texas, too. What you do find, going back to that take-up thing, we found their lower take-up rates are disproportionately in more rural areas. We didn't necessarily go to explain why, but like in the major metro areas, take-up rates are pretty good. You also have a lot of homeowners that are on mortgages. Rural areas, I know, are disproportionately, hypothetically, it's because people there are disproportionately older, might not need to have insurance anymore legally or per regulation. So I think that's something to keep in mind, that you might find this more in rural areas. And also, we found the areas of Texas that did kind of have these larger increases, a lot of them were disproportionately rural.
Could we be focusing too much on premiums? We also know that deductibles could be rising quite a bit, or there could be creating these really narrow coverage policies that are almost like insurance in name only. Homeowners are still really exposed if something bad happens to their house.
Yeah, I think that that's a very important point to make, is that we looked in this research only at rates. We did not look at deductibles, which is an important point to note.
Is there a trend? Is this accelerating? What can people expect?
I mean, I would expect it to go up more when you're seeing this kind of exponential growth curve now in insurance costs. You know, it sounds like 30% a year. Oh, 30% over 1 year. Oh, that's bad. But then if it becomes 30% increase over the next year, and then 30% increase over the year after that, you're starting to see rates. You know, we've seen about a 400% increase in homeowners insurance premiums, nominal value, since 2000. So, you know, this is not something that seems to be plateauing like home prices have. So I would just assume that if your insurance bill was bad this year, brace for it being even worse next year.
Steve Sherman is the Associate Director of Research at the Kender Institute for Urban Research Center for Housing and Neighborhoods at Rice University. A new analysis confirms that many of the harmful conditions inside the Texas Juvenile Justice Department that the Department of Justice deemed unconstitutional in 2024 persist. The report, Behind the Concrete Walls, Uncovering Conditions in Texas's Five Youth Prisons, shows that the chronic staffing shortages contribute to unsafe conditions like violence. The report also reveals children's clear mental health distress. Brett Murfish is an attorney and the director of youth justice for Texas Appleseed.
Right off the bat, I want people to know that not much has changed from the data we're able to see since the DOJ, the Department of Justice, you know, released a report showing that there were unconstitutional conditions in all five state secure lockups for youth. And, you know, we can't go in like the DOJ can, but the things we were able to tell don't tell a very com they tell a very sad story of what's happening inside these lockups.
What are you finding?
We're finding, you know, the highest turnover of staff of any agency. So that frontline staff that's with youth every day ranges from 60% to 87% turnover across those facilities, high vacancy rates. You know, when you're both understaffed and you have high turnover, you don't really have any continuity for youth. Because of those staffing, you know, youth are also sitting at counties on a wait list to go to TJJD, to go to this place where programming is lacking, where, you know, their mental health needs likely aren't being met. You know, we're seeing youth that have more mental health needs go into the facility. So they have what's called adverse childhood experiences, kind of measures, you know, your risk. And, you know, for the youth that are entering, 52% have four or more ACEs. That's very high, and even more for girls. And when you have those ACEs, your risk of, for instance, like suicide attempts goes up. So we're seeing, you know, fewer youth in the facilities, if we look back historically, but higher needs, and a system that isn't really prepared to address those needs. We have the same system with the same staffing issues, the same turnover issues, and so their needs really can't be met.
So who goes into the Texas juvenile justice system? What are their ages?
You can be as young as 10 and then as old as 16. You know, if you're 17, you're considered an adult under our code. You can be older, so you can stay in the juvenile in these facilities till you're 19, at which point you would either be paroled out, released, or you could and put on probation, or you could be transferred to the adult system.
And 10 years old, because in the state of Texas, we consider 10 the age of criminal responsibility.
Correct. There are not many children that young. You know, most of the children are kind of clustered in like 15, 16 area age range. Obviously, they go up as they age through the system, but like at the age of commitment, that's the general ones that you see more of.
What kind of events have to happen in order for a child to be put into this system?
There are certain felonies that make you eligible to be committed. It kind of just depends on what resources your county has, what the prosecutor pursues. you know, what they think will help rehabilitate you, but also if they're able to find a placement for you. So we've seen, like, you know, there used to be more private placements in the state of Texas. So, like, if a county juvenile department couldn't serve you, you might go to a private placement. We've seen a decrease in that. And we also don't have a lot of psychiatric beds. So, like, a lot of youth are coming in with more mental health needs. This is really, like, where they're getting funneled because there aren't other places where they can go. They need to be inpatient maybe, but there's just no other options. You know, we see youth coming in with more mental health needs. That suicide risk assessment that is done in calendar year 2022, we saw 9,500 roughly. This year we saw 14,000 in the calendar year 2025. So it just gives you a sense, like, of the struggle that youth are, you know, undergoing in these facilities. And I believe that their, you know, their needs are largely unmet. You know, mental health was part of the DOJ's report. They showed that, you know, there were a lack of mental, of continuous quality mental health care for youth. So some would go for like a month without any sessions. We're unable to see that data, which is troubling in the sense that we don't have that transparency. But based on the data I can see, right? So like this, the count of suicide risk assessments, it's troubling. I would also say that the use of force is another area where we saw, you know, increases that raise questions. So, you know, once again, it's kind of interesting, the number of youth subject to use of force. So when we talk about use of force, we're talking about mechanical restraints, so like handcuffs. We're talking about OC spray, which is pepper spray. Texas is in a minority of states where correctional officers in our juvenile facilities at the state level carry pepper spray, one of only four states in the country to do that. And so we saw a use of all of these types of use of force, you know, like manual restraints also. So in calendar year 2022, we saw 3,400 total number of instances of use of force. In this year, calendar year 2025, we saw 12,700. I think these numbers speak to, hey, something's going on, and you know that there needs to be more scrutiny of the system and the treatment kids are getting.
So in calendar year 2025, 89% of the youth were prescribed psychotropic medication.
Correct, which is another increase.
Why is that significant? Why should we be paying attention to that?
I think, you know, we always know that the, you know, I think one of the, I'm not an expert in psychology, but one of the tenets is that, you know, therapy plus medications is often the best way to help someone in need. That sort of jump, though, makes you wonder, well, what is going on there? It just raises questions, you know? There's so many reasons that could be. And we don't really, I don't have a good answer for your listeners.
I mean, could they be over-medicating them in order
sure.
to manage them?
I think those are all possible. I can't say, you know, based on only this number, but I think it's worth the public knowing, hey, look at this sharp increase. You know, I think if you look at TJJD's website, sometimes they'll say, well, we have, you know, a higher percentage of violent crimes. Well, I would say, yes, you do, but you have fewer kids than you used to, right? Than pre-2020, the numbers haven't gone back to our pre-pandemic levels. So what's happening is the system's actually working because youth who don't need to be this deep in the system hopefully aren't, right? They're getting treated at the county level. They're getting probation. They're getting family therapy. So your youth that have more intense needs are the ones that are ending up at this deep end of the system. We need to adapt the deep end so that we can help them instead of allowing them to sink.
This is a sunset year for the Texas Juvenile Justice Department. The legislature will be taking a hard look at that.
Yes. You know, I think that the legislative session is going to be very interesting for juvenile justice. So, you know, anyone who cares about this issue should definitely get involved. The sunset process this time for juvenile justice is limited to regionalization. So the idea that, you know, we should be serving kids closer to home and more regionally. Of course, it's all interconnected. And I do hope that there's, you know, a real sort of reckoning with how we are, how good are we doing and what we could do better.
What are parents saying about the status of their children who are in this system?
You know, we talked to some parents for our report, and I have to say it was difficult for them. You know, I think it's always difficult to have your child, you know, in a facility like this, but many of them, you know, almost agreed to this because they thought, you know, this is really going to help my kid. Like, this is the last chance, or, you know, this will be good. They'll get the help they need. And time and time again, it was just like, as soon as our kids got in there, I felt like they said, okay, well, now we're in survival mode. Like, this isn't what it was promised to be to me. And now I just need to get my kid out of here alive and without another charge. And I think that's really, really unfortunate, but that's the reality of what I hear from parents.
What reform would you look for? What do you think the legislature should strive to do?
I think to shift away from these large facilities, try and serve more kids in their counties, invest in prevention and intervention programs. You know, one thing that we've seen, I don't know if it's a trend, but I think a really encouraging thing is programs where family violence, for instance, can be an entry point into the juvenile system. So instead of, you know, if a youth threatens another family member, maybe even with a knife or, you know, something, a violent threat, instead of pulling them into the system, evaluating their case and seeing if they're a candidate for diversion and then family therapy. Because when you have youth acting like that, it's not always because a sign of future criminality, right? It could be some family dynamics at home that are incredibly challenging and can be worked through differently than pulling them into like detention. And so I think it's, you know, thinking of things like that, investing in prevention and intervention, investing in community-based organizations who can provide the services. You know, we see with like gun violence and gun violence prevention, you know, credible messenger programs and programs that identify who's at risk of committing a violent crime with a firearm are the best ways to prevent. And so investing in those kind of things, I think, is where I'd like to see us go instead of doubling down on facilities that clearly are broken.
Brett Murfish is an attorney and the director of youth justice for Texas Appleseed. Take the mania of cryptocurrency and mix in the vibe of the Texas nationalist movement, and you get TexitCoin. It's a blockchain digital currency that has run into problems with the law. On Monday, the Texas State Securities Board will present its fraud enforcement case against TexitCoin. I decided to take a look at what's behind TexitCoin.
TexitCoin promotes itself as a digital currency created in Texas for people who want an alternative to banks and traditional money. But the cryptocurrency and its related crypto mining operations now face allegations of securities fraud from Texas regulators. Last February, the Texas State Securities Board issued TexitCoin, its founder Bobby Gray, and related companies an emergency cease and desist order. Regulators allege TexitCoin's mining packages were unregistered securities sold through a multi-level marketing system. The mining packages are passive investments in crypto mining operations that Gray called seats on the TexitCoin rocket ship.
And they wanted us to stop offering these alleged securities in Texas.
TexitCoin's slogan is built in Texas, mined in Texas, owned by Texans. But Gray isn't in Texas. He spoke from his boat in Singapore. He left Texas immediately after the cease and desist order on what he called a self-imposed exile. He has complied with the order to stop selling crypto mining packages, but he continues his online promotion of TexitCoin.
Crypto is very confusing. The industry is full of scams. And so it's understandable that that the TSSB took an interest in the project and did what they did, not that we like it.
Gray said TexitCoin is not a scam, but that's the word critics like Tom Tolka used to describe it.
I saw the TexitCoin people and all their paraphernalia and their marketing, and it just seemed like a really kind of dirty scam to trick people, you know, based on their political beliefs.
Tolka is a journalist covering crypto for DisruptionBanking.com. There is a website called TexitScam.com that documents some of the issues with the digital currency. Again, Gray said TexitCoin is not a scam, but a community currency that picks up where Bitcoin left off.
I don't know what the trolls say. I know that we've got quite a group of people that have dedicated their time and energy to spreading lies about us.
TexitCoin's mining partner, MineTXE, sold packages that entitled buyers to a share of coins produced by its mining network. Participants could also earn commissions and bonuses by recruiting additional buyers. But Gray said that does not make TexitCoin a pyramid scheme because a classic pyramid scheme has no real product.
We have an extremely valuable product, and also we have a whole bunch of caps and limitations inside of our referral program that make it so that we've got more than a 20 times the national average rate of somebody actually getting a specific benefit out of their participation.
Texit Coin's website says its mining operation has generated roughly $148 million in gross sales from approximately 55,000 participants. Tolka says many of these are supporters of Texas nationalism.
I would say it's associated with a political movement. It's built around the idea of Texit.
Danny Miller, president of the Texas Nationalist Movement, says they are not connected to Texit Coin.
I don't like it, but you know, there's not really anything we could do about it.
Miller says anyone can grab the word Texit and use it, and the Texas Nationalist Movement does not profit in any way from Texit Coin. Gray also said there is no relationship with the Texas Nationalist Movement.
I'm not familiar with the Texas Nationalist Movement. We have no affiliation with them. I know of them.
But the Texit Coin website explicitly promotes the Texas Nationalist Movement. It praises Danny Miller and the Texit Movement. It links directly to the Texas Nationalist Movement's website, Instagram, and X accounts, and tells readers to give them a follow. Also, in an extended online monologue about the origin of Texit Coin, Gray explains that he first heard about Texit while listening to the Joe Rogan podcast.
And I started looking into that, came across the Texas Nationalist Movement and these Republic of Texas folks, and there's some really great people there, some weird ones as well.
Gray said he recognized the opportunity to merge cryptocurrency with the separatist movement, which he supported.
If you talk to a Texan, man, most of us are saying, let's go. We don't know what the federal government's doing. We don't understand it. We don't really want to be lumped in with those weirdos. Let's go back to where it was before. Let's be our own country once again.
And Gray has pitched that if Texas secedes, Texit Coin could be the national currency. He has called it the future of money in Texas.
But we don't know what the future holds for Texas or Texans. And we would like to imagine that if Texas and its people chose to make it a political change, that they would have an honest currency that they could use instead of coming up with a new debt-based fiat currency.
Journalist Tolka said this narrative is very exciting for many who support Texas secession, whom he described as Texit Coin's customer base.
And it's a ragtag bunch of people that are noobs. You know, they don't know anything about crypto.
Many of these investors bought Texit Coin mining operations, thinking the value of the currency would increase and they would get rich. However, that is not the case, Tolka said. Gray said the cryptocurrency has had its ups and downs.
We briefly got very close to $7 in September of 2025, and we've been as low as 5, 6, 7, 8 cents in the last few months. So quite the range.
The Texas State Securities Board is holding an evidentiary hearing beginning Monday to determine whether Gray and Texit Coin violated the Texas Securities Act by selling unregistered securities and not disclosing critical information, including Gray's previous bankruptcy from a venture called Mulligan Mint. Gray said he has been transparent about that failed business where there is a dispute over missing and unpaid for silver.
Which is just, completely untrue. In fact, it was a regular conversation topic for us because what happened in my life back in 2013 had such a profound effect and impact on my ability to do this project as well as I've done it.
Gray and Texit Coin deny wrongdoing and argue that the mining packages represent participation in a legitimate proof-of-work mining pool, not securities.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can subscribe to Texas Matters wherever you get cool podcasts, and tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.